Let me tell you first that we have our new journal. This is something we've been publishing for almost 20 years. It's a scholarly journal. It gives our young people, our young academics and scholars, a chance to publish. Dr. Hans Hoppe has taken over editorship from Murray Rothbard, and Hans is a terrific editor, and I recommend very strongly that you take a look at Pyro Journal and also possibly buy a subscription for yourself and for your favorite universities and colleges. Surprisingly, we are very well represented in the libraries of all European institutions, but not so much here in this country. Second, for those of you who may not know, we have another conference tomorrow. It starts tonight with a reception, the John Randolph Club. If you need any encouragement, take a look at the program. It's as good as today's program. Many of the same people will participate. So if indeed you're not signed up for the Randolph Club, capture me someplace and we'll make sure we make a deal for you. I might add that for those who are not subscribers to the RRR, we have a special. We'll give you a special subscription rate, and particularly with Christmas coming, you may want to put people on your gift list, and you'll get a bonus as well. I won't tell you what the bonus is. It's an autographed picture of me, is what I'm going to ask. Well, you could throw darts at it. Everybody else does. You might as well, Floyd. Well, once again, if our little publication, the Rothbard-Rockwell report, I would say Llewellyn Rockwell has been the rock. If Murray was the faith and the beacon, Llewellyn was the rock. He is a superb editor, and I always tell about Llewellyn. He's not tough. He's not. Don't believe that he's tough. But there's two things I do of a morning. First, I check the obituaries, make sure I'm not in there. That's to start the day. Secondly, I call Llewellyn Rockwell to make sure he's not mad at me. And if I pass on both scores, I know it's going to be a good day. I recall some years ago, Llewellyn was here on one of the major talk shows, and he was, at that time, he was in his anti-environmentalist phase, which I think he still is. And he was being interviewed, and some woman called from Marin County called up, and she said, "I'd like to talk to your guest." And the host said, "Mr. Rockwell." She said, "Mr. Rockwell, I don't know you, but I hate you." That was her comment. Lou will be on the program later, but I would like him to introduce our first speaker. Llewellyn?
Thank you, Bert. We mentioned that we have a number of Murray's books and other publications in the back, too. Jeff Tucker, Jeff, would you raise your hand? If anybody wants to buy them, Jeff can help you. Well, we start off this morning with all our speakers are favorites of Murray's, and he especially was an admirer of Dr. Michael Levin. Dr. Levin is professor of philosophy at City College of New York, author of a lot of important books, including a book I'm always grateful that Murray introduced me to, the best book I ever written on feminism as far as he was concerned, and certainly as far as I'm concerned, Feminism and Freedom. And he's going to talk to us today about his new book, whose title is Why Race Matters. Dr. Levin.
Thank you. Let me first describe how the book came to be created, what its current status is, and what's in it, and contrast it with other books that exist. At the moment, it is what Stephen Jay Gould would call a reified book. A manuscript is at a pretty good publisher. It's been there since March. They sent it to two anonymous referees, which I think is a good thing. I frankly wouldn't want a book published. In fact, I wouldn't want to be associated with a publisher that published me on the strength of my own name. But they did send it to anonymous referees who said, go ahead and publish it. But the press got a little bit cold feet and wanted to send it to a third referee just to be sure. Now they're having trouble finding a third referee, so the thing remains in limbo. This is, of course, very frustrating. Agonizing. The advantage, I suppose, has been it's given me time to keep it updated and keep it revised, so it'll be a better book for that reason, but I sure do wish that they'd say something. The book basically began in 1991, when there was a conference of the usual suspects, involving myself, Arthur Jensen, Phil Rushton, Linda Gottfredson, Herrnstein, Murray, Dan Vining, and Roger Pearson. And it seemed about time to write a book about race differences, the possible genetic causes, and their implications, not just for public policy, but to try to put it in some sort of broad philosophical perspective. Well, apparently, this was an idea whose time has come, and in the intervening period, we've had, of course, Herrnstein and Murray's book, Rushton's book, a very good book, D'Souza's book that came out recently, not such an excellent book, a little disorganized, Dan Seligman's book, which didn't receive sufficient attention back in 92, Jared Taylor's book, which doesn't go into anything, any of the scientific questions about causality and so on, but it's still a very good book to have. Again, just autobiographically, one thing that's sort of delayed publication is that my university frowns on my teaching this material, even in graduate seminars. So my teaching obligations are completely distinct from the research that goes into this book. As you probably know, a lot of professors will teach their research and submit their research to graduate students for criticism. And so it's a great savings in time, as well as getting good feedback. I don't have that opportunity, so it's taking a little bit more time. Okay, what the book is about and what the book attempts to do, I suppose, is to state the hereditarian argument for group differences as carefully as possible, and particularly, and this is something that Herrnstein and Murray and Rushton do not do, in my view, adequately, meet some of the technical criticisms that have emerged to them. I don't want to turn this into a seminar in statistics and genetics, but I do want to just briefly touch on some of these criticisms and how I think they should be handled. Some of these criticisms have emerged in not the popular hysterical reaction to Herrnstein and Murray, but in the technical literature, in the scientific journals that's appeared. And I suppose one of the silver lining to the cloud of having my own book's publication come later is I can sort of keep track of these things and include it. And also try to put these differences, as I say, in a very broad perspective. What do they mean? What are their real implications? That's, I think, not something that Herrnstein, Murray, Rushton, D'Souza, anybody really has gotten straight. Now, I'm not a statistician or a geneticist, but I do, my training is in logic and philosophy of science, so I do feel I'm competent. I expect to get jumped on. I know Murray has gotten jumped on. He apparently made one flub on national television, and that was it. And I do feel confident to undertake it. Okay, what are some of the basic points of the book and some of the basic errors that need to be corrected that have emerged? I'm not now describing the book in the order of the chapters, but what I think for us and for the United States would be the principal points to focus on. First, I would make a broad distinction, which I don't think has been made, between what I call forward-looking and backward-looking views of right and wrong. Now, probably a lot of you have read, I'm just curious, read the relevant parts of Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia. Is that a book? No, perhaps it isn't. But in any case, all right. Okay, well, unfortunately, well, the basic idea is that very often what you should do about a situation doesn't depend depends crucially on how it came about. You're not so much thinking about what would be the best way to handle it in the future, the best way to maximize total social satisfaction, but simply the rights and wrongs that emerge from its history. This is basically the point in Nozick's book, a kind of self-evident point, but often obscured. For instance, suppose the two of us are standing together in cold weather. You're freezing and I've got a sweater. Now, the approach of government, the government and interventionists is simply, who would be better off with my sweater, you or me? Now, the fact is, from a common sense point of view, the first question that arises is, whose sweater is it? How did I acquire the sweater in the first place? If I took it from you, then I should give it back. And the government is entitled to make me give it back because that's theft. If I made the sweater or bought the sweater, then it's mine, and you're going to have a much harder time saying that I should give it to the other guy, even if he'd be warmer than the sweater makes me. Now, one of the difficulties in discussions of race differences is that all authors, first of all, Herrnstein and Murray, as much as their critics, all focus on the forward-looking question. Given that the race differences exist, given their the possible involvement of genetics, what can be done about them? Will intervention work? Are intervention programs feasible? Herrnstein and Murray concentrate on the futility to date of Head Start and the Perry Project and other efforts to boost intelligence and say, see, it's a waste of money. Critics, and I'll be discussing some of these criticisms because they're weak in their own grounds, but in any case, critics reply, no, we don't know yet. Maybe over the horizon there's some untried intervention that will somehow equalize the races, close the race gap, and so we should keep trying, keep pouring the money in. Now, that seems to me the wrong way to pose the question because it's a forward-looking question. The real question is, how did the race difference come about? If it came about as is the conventional theory, the result of bad things whites did to blacks, then in some general sense, whites owe blacks some sort of rectification. Now, it may well be that affirmative action programs and so on are wrong because of the familiar criticisms. They're too broad spectrum, that blacks who benefit from a compensatory program are not maybe the particular ones that are injured. The whites who have to make sacrifices are not the ones that discriminated. But in some broad way, if the fault is that of whites, then whites as a group owe blacks as a group something in some broad sense. So the real importance of the genetic question is not what can be done about it in the future, but whether genetic differences or even environmental differences that are not the fault of whites caused the race differences in the past. Now, it's my view, for reasons perhaps if I have time I can go into, to think that these differences were caused almost entirely by genetic factors and environmental factors that whites were not responsible for. That being the case, what can be done about these differences is completely irrelevant. The fact is, if this is true, whites don't owe blacks anything, don't owe them compensation, because the difficulties blacks have are not the fault of whites. Now, one of the things I do in the book, which I think will be one of its strengths, is go over a lot of the arguments for affirmative action and racial preferences, which are alleged not to be compensatory, and try to show that in virtually every case they are compensatory. And I think you know some of these arguments. Affirmative action proponents have perfected this little gavotte that they do. When one argument fails, they march over to another argument, and when that fails, they march over to another argument. Well, you can do that indefinitely, but most of the arguments are really compensatory. For example, the role model argument, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, young blacks need role models. Well, the natural question is, what's wrong with the number of role models there are? Aren't white children entitled to white role models? The question that you have to pose is, why isn't this number sufficient? And the only answer anybody can seem to think of, for example, Gerald Dworkin, an extremely influential legal theorist who's defended affirmative action, is there aren't enough black role models. And why is that? Because of our history of racism. So the real reason we're supposed to have role models is not because of the inspiration they supply, but to make up for a lack that whites caused. And we're right back to the compensatory argument. If the absence of role models is not the result of something whites did, but of largely genetic differences in intelligence, then we're not obligated to correct the number of role models. It should be, other things being equal, let itself play out in accordance with, you might say, the market. Now, even on the level of intervention, as a common fallacy that's made, I've noticed, in the literature that's come after Herrnstein and Murray, there is a very influential review in an economics journal by Goldberger and Mansky. Christopher Jenks has made this point. Ned Block made this point, made the same argument in a very recent issue of Cognition. Christopher Jenks has made this argument. Richard Lewontin keeps making it like a broken record, as I say, that just because in the past we haven't been able to find a favorable environment, how do we know that we won't find one in the future where the races converge? This is associated with a genetic phenomenon called the norm of reaction or the range of reaction, the idea being that the way a gene expresses itself, it expresses itself differently in different environments. And in fact, in one set of environments, two genes may express themselves very differently. In another set of environments, they may express themselves very similarly. And this point is banged away over and over and over by critics of the hereditarians. Now, the fact is that this argument, as I try to show, confuses, you might say, what is possibly possible with what is actual. That is, there are many genetic traits which don't have this flexibility, which don't have this broad range of reaction. For example, eye color. Once you're born and manage to survive into childhood, your eye color is fixed, no matter what you eat, what the temperature is, what kind of education you get. These critics of hereditarians invariably have lots of made-up graphs, invented graphs where these two curves intersect, what are called the norms of reaction for different genes. They all intersect and they say, why can't the black and white genes be like this? One point I drive home over and over again is, why can't the genes be like the genes for eye color? Well, they don't converge no matter what you do. So quite apart from this confusion about forward-looking and backward-looking, this technical argument is quite unsound. Unfortunately, it's dressed up in a lot of fancy mathematics, which makes the issue rather impenetrable to most outsiders. And you find 10 experts saying hereditarians are confused. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to step in. Another technical confusion, which I go into. In fact, as I look at my notes here, there's a lot of technical confusions, but professors are supposed to do, which you've probably heard about, is it's constantly said that the hereditarian position confuses between individual and between group heritability. What this means is that you might have a trait, individual differences between which are due to genes, but group differences are not. For example, height is highly heritable. That is, if you take just any two people on the street at random that differ greatly in height, you'll probably find that their genes differ. Does it follow that if you have two groups whose height differs on average, that that's because the genes of the groups differ? And the answer is no. And this is a point that critics of Jensen have been banging away at for a quarter of a century. It may be that if you take one group of people, bring them up in a dark mine shaft and never feed them and never allow them exercise and bind their feet for 25 years, they'll come out short, even though they've got the same sort of genes as another group who from birth have been put on some sort of stretching Procrustes bed sort of program, so they're maxed out at their limits of growth. And so it's said that the two issues are just distinct and that Jensen, Herrnstein, and Murray are constantly inferring between group from between individual differences. Again, it's a highly technical issue. I know it's kind of coming thick and fast, but I do go into that, and I do suggest a couple of ways of inferring likely between group differences from between individual differences. Somewhat mathematical. I've shown it. Some of it is known in among geneticists. Some other stuff is my own massaging of the numbers. I've shown this to some behavioral geneticists who have vetted it, said, yeah, the reasoning is right. There are ways of going from one to the other. And the basic conclusion I draw is that there's, I mean, this sounds like the kind of absurd precision you can't really get in life, but there's less than a 1% chance that the differences, the 15-point IQ differences between blacks and whites, all things considered, less than a 1% chance that that's due to differences in environment between the two groups, acting, different environments acting on potentially similar genes. I'm hoping that this part of the book is eventually picked up and eventually discussed in the technical literature. We can put that fallacious objection away. Another issue that's come up, I should mention, since the appearance of Herrnstein and Murray, is the so-called Flynn effect. IQ apparently has been rising in the West at 3 points a decade for as long as there's been any record, back to the 1930s. Now, I'm very skeptical about that, because that would imply, if we extrapolate it back, that the Industrial Revolution was founded by idiots, and that the Renaissance, the average IQ during the Renaissance was about 10. So there's something going on here. And I'm unfortunately not really an expert in these questions enough to know just what that something is. And do you have a sense the world is suddenly full of geniuses lately? The SAT scores are going through the roof. Public discourse is more intelligent than it used to be. Situation comedies are less vulgar than they used to be. But in any case, I discussed this Flynn effect, which has also been thrown up to hereditarians, and try to show that it too doesn't really show that group differences are due to environment. The basic reasoning is if you have a general change in the environment, whose nature is apparently unknown, but a general change over the last 60 years that's kept the group differences intact, what you should really conclude is that you have two different sorts of genes reacting differently to a common environment. Not that all differences in intelligence of every sort is due to environment, because you have everybody's IQ rising at the same time. I suppose the analogy would be if you have a tide lifting all boats, and one guy standing on one deck was 10 feet lower than a guy standing on another deck when this started, and at the end of it all, one guy is still 10 feet higher than the other, you don't conclude that the original difference is due to the tide. You conclude they're standing on different boats, both of which got raised the same height. Another thing I go into, which you've probably heard about, is this idea which, unfortunately, Herrnstein and Murray don't discuss, Rushton doesn't really discuss, is that there are different kinds of intelligence, or that the word intelligence has different meanings in different groups. Now, this is the kind of thing, as soon as you start talking about meaning, definitions, kind of philosophers begin to salivate at this one. And unfortunately, my original discussions were probably very involved, involuted. And maybe it was a good thing that publication has been held back as I've simplified, but I really want to attack this idea. You know, Gardner had a book that came out recently, I think it was called Frames of Mind, I don't remember off the top of my head, arguing there are seven kinds of intelligence. There's what I like to call intelligent intelligence, namely being intelligent. Then there's being a good athlete. That's called kinesthetic intelligence. Personal leadership is personal intelligence. Is this new thing of emotional intelligence. I think that's all nonsense, playing with words, basically, and I try to show that at some length. Stephen Jay Gould, hasn't stopped saying there's no such thing as intelligence. He calls it reification. Says there's no, if you open up somebody's brain, you're not going to find a little intelligence thingy in there. If you squeeze the brain, you're not going to get a little intelligence fluid coming out. Therefore, there's no such thing as intelligence. Herrnstein, Murray, Jensen, don't really answer that. They just cite authorities, particularly Herrnstein and Murray, they cite authorities saying, yes, it is such a thing. ISINC has defended intelligence by saying it's a construct. It's like phlogiston. Well, with friends like phlogiston is a non-existent substance. With friends like that, intelligence doesn't need critics. So again, I really try to consider this objection in a lot of scientific, in a lot of detail. And the basic argument is that intelligence is a bit like solubility. You take a sugar cube, put it in water, it dissolves. That's a fact. When we talk about the solubility of the sugar cube, doesn't mean you can take the solubility out of the sugar cube, squeeze the sugar cube, and out comes the solubility, you put it on the shelf. There isn't any one little solubility molecule amidst all the sugar molecules, yet solubility is a real phenomenon, and sugar is more soluble in quartz, which is more soluble, I suppose, than steel. This is the basic fallacy. I try to make that point at some length. Now, what are some of the broader policy implications, not just sort of social policy, but sort of in our thinking about these things? Well, first of all, I do try to make an argument which D'Souza makes in his recent book. I won't say where he got it, but he does say, he does thank me for letting him see a preliminary copy of my book. And I know he has a lot of arguments that you could have fooled me, we're in Jared Taylor, that are unsighted. And in fact, a lot of the documentation that he gives for these arguments are in Jared Taylor's book. And I don't see, it would be, I know sometimes great minds can arrive independently at identical conclusions, but read identical articles in the New York Times and cite them, I find that very implausible. So we'll leave it obscure where he got these things. One is a defense of certain forms of discrimination. Sometimes it's reasonable to discriminate. What does that mean? Well, Dinesh D'Souza just gives examples like avoiding a taxi cab, an example I give. Taxi cab drivers not wanting to pick up black fares because of the danger, and he says that's quite rational. I sort of want to extend that to some extent, that the general desire, not just on the part of whites, but even on the part of blacks, to sort of keep to themselves is perfectly reasonable, given that they have different values, different behavioral traits, that there's probably even genetic reasons to think that one prefers the company of those like oneself for reasons. Theoretical reasons are probably built that way. People who like ourselves probably share our genes. Therefore, if we help them, that's good for our genes. Our genes are yelling at us, so to speak, help copies of us, please. So it's perfectly reasonable to want, in a sort of negative way, to discriminate in favor of those like ourselves. By a negative way, I mean non-invasive discrimination. Simply deal with those like ourselves, possibly like ourselves racially more than otherwise. It's not a justification for any kind of aggressive discrimination, going out and beating someone up because of his race. That's wrong. But the reason it's wrong is not because it's discriminatory, but simply because it's aggression and assault. At no point do you really have to reach discrimination as a basis for something being wrong, in my view. One, and I think this is important, because probably the major argument for the Civil Rights Act when it was passed, and I'm not talking about affirmative action, but just making private discrimination illegal. I remember this from the 60s when I was younger, but I was still old enough to remember, follow the discussion, is that racial discrimination is irrational. Race means nothing, tells you nothing about a person. The only thing it tells you about a person is that he may have been damaged by the discrimination that these laws are supposed to remove. Now, Americans like individual liberty. They like freedom of association. But they're also somewhat suspicious of any freedom when they think it's being abused. And since they were convinced that freedom of association was being abused, that white desire not to deal with blacks was totally irrational, that you had to be nuts not to want to deal with a member of another race. And if you look at not only the literature of that time, but even the literature of this time, that assumption is still in force. So just to digress for a second, there's a recent book called Justice and Affirmative Action by I can't remember his name. He teaches a law professor at Yeshiva University, saying, why would someone want to discriminate? And he only can consider one reason, that someone thinks God has told him to, and God has told him he has a mission to purify his race by force. That, Rosenfeld is his name. Rosenfeld, that's the only reason he can think of why anyone would want to discriminate. Gerald Dworkin thinks, why would someone want to discriminate? Well, because, once again, he's a racist, and if there's medicine, and there's a sick black man and a sick white man, then he wants to see the black man die. That's the only reason anyone could want to discriminate, just to see blacks hurt and see them die. Well, I think once you fight through that and see that there are lots of reasonable, benign reasons for whites wanting to deal with whites and presumably blacks wanting to deal with blacks, this philosophical grounding for all civil rights legislation just falls away, as I say, quite apart from our right to private association, which got trampled on. Some of these desires are perfectly reasonable. A very interesting issue that constantly comes up, which I try to speak about at some length, because I think this is the sort of thing that philosophers are good at, is the idea that race consciousness denies people the right to be treated as individuals. We have all heard that. I'd be surprised if anyone in this room hasn't heard that hundreds of times. Race consciousness is bad because it ignores individuality. I spend the chapter analyzing that and conclude there is absolutely nothing to it, that this is nonsensical. The fact is that all people's traits are traits they share with others. What it means to treat somebody as an individual is simply to pay attention to those of his traits which enable us to predict his behavior and tell us something about the sort of person he's going to prove to be in other contexts. All judgment of individuals always categorizes them. There's no getting away from it. Someone's race is, for reasons that you have to blame on God, I believe, not discrimination, tell us something about him. Taking someone's race into account is treating him as an individual. You know, when I say it just like that, it sounds so self-evident, I wonder why I spend 25 pages discussing it. But someone once said about astrology that it takes astrologers 30 seconds to say something which is wrong and then 30 minutes to explain why it's wrong. And I think a lot of the things said about race are like that. Now, finally, the question arises, what's the broad attitude that we should take toward race differences? Now, I have to say I kind of funk it in the book, because I was trying to woo another editor, and while my own views are strongly free market, I tried in the last chapter an imaginary speech by the President of the United States finally facing up to the race problem, and recognizing the existence of race differences, sort of laying out different solutions, sort of interventionist solutions, free market solutions, combination solutions, without really taking sides, although I think any reader can see where my heart semi-secretly is. But I think the biggest divide is between a race-blind approach and a race-conscious approach. And you might suppose that since there are these I think real, profound genetic differences in the races, not just in intelligence, but in motivation, personality, time preferences. You might think that race consciousness is sort of an inevitable corollary, but I don't think it is. I think if you take an individual liberty approach, 99.9% of all decisions that anybody makes or the government makes about anything can be race blind. But it has to be what I call realistic race blindness. We have to accept the fact that that anything we do will have disparate impact on the races. Like, we just have to disabuse ourselves of the idea that, for example, if you track, one example that comes to mind, if you track students by ability, so many educators are against that. Why are they against it? They give nonsensical reasons. For example, it's good for good students to be with bad students. Have you heard this one? Oh, I see you have. It's good for good students to be with bad students because then they have to explain the stuff to the bad students and then they understand it better. And this, can anybody believe this? This is so ridiculous. I don't think anybody believes it. The real reason, of course, is that people know what happens when you track by ability. The high-level classes get mostly Asians and whites and very, very few blacks. The not-so-able get mostly blacks, non-white Hispanics. What I think we have to do is simply recognize that that's going to happen and factor it out. Just say it doesn't matter. If there's a good reason to do something, and the only reason not to do it is that it'll have disparate racial impact, we just have to recognize it's going to happen and make that decision. This is true in public policy. It's true in private life. I think people now are even inhibited about making private decisions. Some, say a family wants to form some sort of science club for his kids, and they think, well, gee, science club, that black culture doesn't, is not that interested in science, so it would be kind of exclusionary, and they feel bad about it. Or their kids listen to rap music, and then they say, gee, this is kind of bad, all this stuff about raping women and killing cops. Maybe, gee, I don't like that in my home, but isn't that kind of racist? So they permit it. I think, you know, if you think it's bad music and bad stuff and all that's holding you back is the feeling that isn't that Eurocentric, then you should do it. I think in a couple of cases, a very small number of cases, at least theoretically, race consciousness should be permitted. And this gets into the somewhat more controversial stuff. For example, I do think there's good evidence, Rushton mentioned some of it, that blacks may mature more quickly than whites. The black life cycle may be accelerated. It's also the case that apparently, for genetic reasons, blacks have shorter time preferences, higher time preferences than whites. This may justify race consciousness and penology. It may justify treating blacks as adult offenders earlier than whites. Ideally, one should give a psychological test to every offender to see his degree of maturity, his susceptibility to deterrence, but you just can't do that. It's like a driver's license. You give everybody a short eye test, and if he can't pass, you don't give him a license. You don't let everybody drive around on the highway and see who starts a multi-car collision, and if he kills five people, you don't give him a license. So, and similarly with welfare, which of course ideally should just end, but if we're not going to end it, you have to recognize that that blacks and whites seem to respond differently to the same welfare incentives, that white illegitimacy has gone up since welfare has come into existence, but black illegitimacy has gone up more. If we're going to keep some sort of safety net, then you have to recognize that. Well, okay, that just summarizes the book. I guess there's no time for questions or comments or anything?
Later.
Okay, later. All right, thank you.